Call the case, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jennifer Brooks, appearing for petitioners. I thank you for the opportunity to argue this morning. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. May it please the Court, OIP would like to focus its arguments on two of the issues in this case, which we believe are likely to have broad future applicability. Those two issues being, first, the question of whether there is a right to sue to challenge an OIP decision made under the UIPA, and second, the question of the scope of the attorney-client exception to open meetings under the Sunshine Law. Now, as to the first point, the County of Kauai brought this action in the first place to avoid compliance with OIP's determination made on a UIPA appeal, Uniform Information Practices Act appeal. Kauai citizens had requested minutes of a county meeting, were denied, and appealed that denial to OIP, and OIP made a determination under the UIPA that the minutes must be disclosed with some redaction. Now, the UIPA provides a universal scheme for public access to all state and county records, with the various other statutory provisions that exist that address access to specific types of records, all folded into the UIPA scheme by reference. This statutory scheme includes a universal remedial scheme, which the legislature designed to be quick, inexpensive, favor the record requester, and provide finality for a record requester in the event of an OIP decision favoring the record requester. Under this remedial scheme, a record requester can appeal a denial of access to OIP, and if OIP upholds the agency's denial, the record requester can still go to court and do so under a de novo standard. However, if OIP should determine that the record must be disclosed, all or in part, then Section 92F15.5B of the UIPA states, quote, "The agency shall make the record available," end quote. The legislative history of this provision makes clear that this lack of agency appeal is intentional. As the Conference Committee report puts it, quote, "While a person has a right to bring a civil action in circuit court to appeal a denial of access to a government record, a government agency dissatisfied with an administrative ruling by the OIP does not have the right to bring an action in circuit court to contest the OIP ruling. The legislative intent for expediency and uniformity in providing access to government records would be frustrated by agencies suing one another."
Ms. Brooks.
Yes.
How do you square that with the provision that states if there is a court order, then that the minutes will not be disclosed?
Your Honor, are you referring to the exception to disclosure, which allows an agency to withhold a record that a court order requires to be withheld?
If there's a court order that, for example, in this case, apparently there is a federal court order pertaining to ES-177, the minutes, how do you square that federal court order with the OIP determination that the same minutes, I assume they're the same minutes, should be disclosed?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I should note that the timing of this particular case, at the time that OIP made its UIPA determination, there was no such court order. Had there been a court order, we would assume that Kauai would, as part of its burden to justify withholding, brought it up. But that federal court order was something that came later. This issue has It's been a number of years since the original request was made. And then as a second matter, certainly if there is an outstanding court order that either requires or permits an agency to withhold records, that is recognized under the UIPA. The UIPA has an exception, 92F13(4), that allows an agency to withhold records when another statute, that would be a federal statute or rule or a state statute, allows withholding, or that, when a court order does so.
Is that federal court order in effect?
A federal court order would certainly be considered a court order. However, at the time of OIP's determination on this matter, there was no court order.
My question was, is a federal court order still in effect?
I don't know, Your Honor.
You don't know?
I don't know. We haven't been tracking
that. If it is in effect, assuming it is in effect, then would that preclude the disclosure of the minutes in this particular case?
Your Honor, I believe that to reopen OIP's determination would require a lawsuit of the sort that the UIPA's remedial scheme does not anticipate and that the legislature intended would not be brought. However, a subsequent court order could perhaps provide grounds for reconsideration. OIP has a standard for reconsideration of its opinions.
Talking about this case or not, 92F13 contemplates that if there is a court order, then the material will not be disclosed. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So it is foreseeable that OIP may make a determination that would be in conflict with a court order?
It is foreseeable. However, Your Honor, it is the agency's burden to bring up a court order or statute or any other argument for withholding at the time of the appeal before OIP.
In the statute that only you have the burden of pointing out that there's a court order?
Your Honor, Section 15, 92F15, places the burden on the agency. That section actually deals with a requester's appeal to circuit court. The OIP appeal section is 15.5.
That's a section that says any person may file suit?
The any person standard is actually found in the Sunshine Law, a separate law. 92.15 allows a record requester who has been denied by an agency to go straight to court. The OIP appeal is an option. They don't have to exhaust that remedy.
If 92F13 says that government records, which should not be disclosed pursuant to state or federal law or state or federal court order, how do you get the federal court order or the state court order?
Your Honor, this would come up, given that the UIPA covers all the state and county records with the exception of the non-administrative records of the judiciary, this could come up in various contexts. For instance, we've had issues where there is a police report having to do with a litigation, family court litigation, and therefore the court has ordered that the police report be sealed. And
my question is much more simple. So do you have to end up in court in order to determine or in order to get a state or federal court order?
The court order would not generally be something that came up as a result of the UIPA litigation, Your Honor. This would be typically an existing court order because a member of the public would make a request for records to an agency. These records might, for one reason or another, be subject to an existing court order, and the agency would then cite to that court order as well as to Section 13(4) as a justification for denying that request for records.
Those limitations you state are not in the rule. You're saying that's ordinarily the case?
I'm sorry, you're...
In the statute, not stated in the statute.
The agency's burden, do you mean, Your Honor?
No, I mean the fact that it only arises in an OIP situation. It wouldn't arise in an OIP situation.
Your Honor, the exception would be available whenever a request is made. The process for making a request provided by the UIPA and under OIP's rules implementing the UIPA would be that a requester makes either an oral or a written request. In the event of a written request, the agency would have to provide a written response. If that response is a denial, the agency would have to specify which exception under the UIPA allows the denial. If a court order were the basis for the denial, the agency would point to Section 13.4, allowing withholding where another statute or court order requires or allows it, and then the agency would also point to the specific court order that allowed it to withhold.
Sort of wind this up. So if there is a federal court order outstanding, as in this case, and OIP makes a determination contrary to the federal court order, then if there's a dispute as to that, would you end up in court?
Your Honor, I think given that there would be jurisdiction as far as the agency is concerned in the action where the original court order was, I think the issue might well end up in court in that sense. I don't know that OIP would necessarily end up in court. However, again, in this case, there was not a court order outstanding at the time of OIP's determination that came a good while later, more than a year later, as I recall.
Were you a party of OIP, a party to the U.S. District Court case?
No, Your Honor, we were not.
Do you know what the specific issues were in that case? I mean, were they specifically different or?
Your Honor, we were not closely involved. Possibly the County of Kauai may have better information since my understanding is that they were a party to that. But it was, I believe that involved a former police chief's claims. I believe it was civil rights or employment discrimination claims. And this was a discovery.
Is the U.S. District Court order binding on you?
No, Your Honor. And I would further note that the court order was made on a different basis. The court order was made in a discovery dispute questioning whether the minutes were protected by the attorney-client privilege squarely, as OIP has argued in its briefs and will argue today. In this case, we're not dealing with the attorney-client privilege as such. We're dealing with the attorney-client exception to the Sunshine Law's open meetings rule, which is not entirely coextensive with the privilege.
How does it differ?
Your Honor, the exception in the Sunshine Law is set out by statute, and therefore it's the specific statutory language of the exception that applies rather than the privilege, broadly speaking. The statutory language allows a board to go into closed session to consult with its attorney on its privileges, duties, powers, and liabilities. And a couple of other points of difference are that the legislature in 1985 actually narrowed this exception. It had previously allowed broader consultation with the board's attorney. The legislature narrowed it out of concern that it might allow a too broad ability to close meetings. In fact, I have the specific language from the committee report here. The legislature, if I can find it. The legislature's concern was that the board should only be able to go into closed session with its attorney to discuss its legal matters, legal issues, and potential claims. And that language is in the committee report from 1985, although I'm paraphrasing.
How's that different from the general attorney-client privilege?
I would say, Your Honor, that the difference is that, first of all, it is constrained by the statutory language rather than existing as a principle. Statutory language found in the exception, so it's a matter of statutory interpretation. Second of all, there is a legislative intent present to narrow the board's ability to go into consultation, in close consultation with its attorney. And third, government attorneys, as a general principle, do not enjoy the attorney-client privilege as broadly as attorneys do in the private sector. This is true elsewhere in the statutes. For instance, the Attorney General's opinions, Section 28.3 requires the Attorney General to publish some of its opinions. Now, this would never be true, of course, of a private sector attorney. The UIPA in Section 92F12A1 provides that legal advice of general applicability that is adopted by an agency is public without exception, mandated to be public. And this, of course, would not be true. I mean, you might, for instance, have private counsel providing advice to a financial client on the scope of a Fair Credit Reporting Act provision. that, of course, would be privileged. It wouldn't become public, even if the financial client was using it, adopted it for its dealings with the public. A government agency, however, doing the same thing would not be privileged, and again, that is under the UIPA by statute. So in this case, we have yet a third statute specifically setting out the scope of this privilege and providing it. Again, it is not entirely different from the attorney-client privilege. It is coextensive to a large extent, but not entirely coextensive, and the limitation does tend to be limited in the direction of narrowing it.
Ms. Brooks, the legislative history you quoted about claims, was that in the limiting of the attorney-client privilege to claims, was that legislative history pertaining to a prior version of the statute?
Your Honor, the legislative history did not indicate that it was limited to claims. Claims were mentioned as an example, but it was limited to legal discussion, legal issues, and legal claims.
In fact, the statute's very broad, isn't it, as far as consultation is concerned?
Your Honor, the statute is specific as to what it covers. It is limited to legal issues.
Is it very broad?
The legislature did not intend it to be so, Your Honor, given that the legislature narrowed it with the intent of making it less broad.
So you think powers to consult with the board's attorney on questions and issues pertaining to the board's powers, duties, privileges, immunities, and liabilities is narrow in scope?
Your Honor, I do think so. And if we look at...
Why do you think that's narrow? Powers, duties, privileges, immunities, and liabilities, as opposed to, say, claims pertaining to litigation, for example?
Undoubtedly, it is less narrow than provisions such as the County of Kauai's charter provision that was in force at the time of this meeting, which do limit meetings to claims. It is less narrow than those. However, I would point out that in this instance, if you look at the minutes in question, much of the discussion is actually not specifically on whether the board has legal authority, legal power to undertake the action proposed and discussed in those minutes, but rather on whether it is politically advisable for the board to undertake that action.
Well, I guess, you know, everything depends on who the reader is, but I have read the minutes, and they seem to fall clearly within powers, duties, privileges, immunities, and liabilities, because the description in the statute is so broad.
Well, I would again point out, Your Honor, that the legislature did not intend it to be broad, and it intended to ensure that only the legal discussion took place. Now, I don't argue the concept that these minutes do contain material that would probably be embarrassing if disclosed, material that is politically sensitive. OIP does recognize that there is some policy interest at play in the county's desire to shield these minutes, because boards do have some interest in the ability
that's your characterization, right, in terms of whether or not it's, I forget you said, embarrassing, et cetera. But does the council ask their attorney about their powers and their duties and whether they would be immune from suit and that kind of thing?
Your Honor, OIP did at one point in the events that led up to this suggest to the county a portion of the minutes that could be redacted. Again, OIP's determination was not that the minutes need be disclosed in full. The determination was that those parts that were genuinely legal advice could be redacted.
Your position is that OIP's determination cannot be reviewed by any other body. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that OIP's UIPA determination, based on the legislative scheme of the UIPA, which favors requester, which favors speed and efficiency over a perfect process, provide for no review.
So then the normal safeguards that would attend to any administrative proceeding, like hearing, presenting witnesses, considering documentary evidence, all that kind of things, would not be applicable to a determination by OIP?
2 points, Your Honor. First of all, the writ of mandamus, of course, remains a possibility should OIP's decision be a flagrant and manifest abuse of discretion as recognized in the Marsland opinion cited in OIP's briefs.
Second, writ of mandamus usually issues primarily for ministerial duties, and the interpretation of the statute would involve some discretion, would it not?
In the Marsland case, State ex rel Marsland v. Shintako, 64 Hawaii 307, this court noted that although the lack of an appeal provision for an agency decision by itself doesn't justify mandamus, mandamus is nonetheless available for a flagrant and manifest abuse of discretion. Now, as a second point, OIP does not provide a contested case process because it is required not to provide a contested case process. The legislature stated that because it intended appeal to OIP to be, quote, expeditious, informal, and at no cost to the public, end quote, the legislature directed it be a contested case, and goes on to say, quote, this provision is necessary to comply with the legislative intent behind Chapter 92F that review by the Office of Information Practices be expeditious, informal, and at no cost to the public.
The legislature in granting OIP the what you say is exclusive right to determine what exception applies or what the statute means, describe this process in a certain way. Do you recall what that description was?
Your Honor means something other than expeditious, informal, and at no cost to the public?
Yes.
And, Your Honor, the legislature goes on to say in this committee report, quote, an explicit statutory exemption from the contested case will serve to avoid future challenges to the administrative procedures of the Office of Information Practices for failure to have contested case hearings.
And did it describe the OIP procedure as, and I may be incorrect, an informal dispute resolution process?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. It is informal compared to the contested case process, and that is by design. And as part of the same design, the legislature did intend and did explicitly state in the legislative history that it intended for agencies not to sue OIP.
Then, even though it may have some substantial impact on people's liability or immunity or duties, your interpretation, OIP's interpretation, of a statute is not subject to any other safeguard other than an informal dispute resolution process.
Yes, Your Honor, as well as a mandamus. I would point out that the legislature could, should it have so chosen, have simply made public records public, period, without putting in these exceptions. The legislature chose to statutorily place exceptions to mandatory disclosure of government records, and the legislature chose to set up a body that would hear appeals of denials under these exceptions.
But the legislative history didn't expressly take up any potential conflict between giving OIP exclusive jurisdiction over an interpretation or application of the statute with the specific exceptions that the legislature enacted as not being subject to disclosure.
Your Honor, OIP would contend that given the legislative history, this was intentional, that the legislature intended to favor finality of process, favoring the requester so that errors would be in favor of the requester over the possibility of multiple appeals and perhaps a more perfect and polished decision.
Ms. Brooks, one
of Judge.
Thank you. Ms. Brooks, one of the issues you raise is whether or not the agency's decision should be given some deference. But it appears to me that the initial decision as to whether or not there is disclosure or non-disclosure is made by another agency other than OIP. And part of their process of making that determination may involve expertise in terms of the area that the agency functions are being exercised by that particular agency, for example, the county of Kauai, in terms of trying to figure out how to do an investigation under their charter. So my question is, to what extent does OIP give deference to any of the agency's determination as to what is disclosable or not.
Your Honor, in the case where a UIPA determination raises a statute outside the UIPA that does not happen, as the Sunshine Law does, to also be within OIP's specific jurisdiction, OIP must interpret the statute to the extent necessary to render a UIPA determination, as OIP is required to do. However, we will give deference to the agency's interpretation of a statute that is within its expertise. In this situation, there was not a statute at issue that was within Kauai's specific expertise, and OIP's statutory role is, in fact, to act as a neutral. Kauai, in representing itself, is, of course, acting in its own interest to protect its interests. The members of the public making the request have their own interests, and OIP was created to serve as a neutral body for these decisions.
Ms. Brooks, if I might ask you, earlier Justice Acoba had asked you about exceptions, and that would be, I think, in particular 92-5-4, which talks about consulting with the board's attorney on questions and issues pertaining to the board's powers and duties, things of that nature. Doesn't that assume that there was a properly held and noticed executive meeting for these exceptions to apply, referring to 92-4?
Your Honor, that is correct. The minutes provision, the Sunshine Law 92-9, the Sunshine Law's minutes provision allows a board to withhold executive session meeting minutes so long as necessary to avoid frustrating the purpose of the meeting. Now, the UIPA, in turn, requires in Section 92F12 that minutes of a meeting required to be public are public without exception. So it is important to determine whether a meeting was properly held in executive session, because if a meeting was not properly held in executive session in the first place, then it was a meeting required to be public, and the minutes would be disclosed in full.
And what is the status of the record as to whether the executive meeting in question was properly noticed and whether there was a vote on holding in open meeting, voting to hold an executive session?
In this case, Your Honor, the council voted in open meeting, although, as you can see from the minutes, they did continue their discussion on whether they were properly in executive session once they were in the executive session itself. So OIP doesn't contend that there was a flaw in the procedural aspect. However, OIP, which was actually asked to make a Sunshine Law decision prior to this UIPA appeal, on the earlier Sunshine Law decision, OIP did find that the majority of the meeting should have been held in public, although portions of it were properly held in executive session under the cited purpose.
Was there an actual recorded vote on going into executive session?
As I recall, that's the case, Your Honor, although I have to say it's been quite a while since I've looked at the public portion of the minutes, since that hasn't been an issue in this case.
Thank you.
Counsel, I'm a little confused here. What was the evidence? What does the record show in terms of the council following the procedures of the Sunshine Law to allow the meeting to be deemed executive or closed meeting? What does the evidence show in terms of meeting all of the procedural requirements?
Your Honor, the Sunshine Law requires for a board to go into...
What does the evidence show in terms of whether the county met those?
Yes, Your Honor. The Sunshine Law first requires giving notice of an anticipated executive session, and on its agenda for this meeting, the county gave notice that it intended to go into executive session. It listed the majority of all the executive session purposes, if not all of them. The reason we're only discussing the attorney-client one is because the others, OIP had also found unsupported, and they've basically fallen by the wayside. My understanding is that the council did indeed vote. A supermajority of two-thirds present is required, and that the council did indeed vote to go into executive session in public, although they did continue their discussion of whether they were properly in executive session in the closed session itself. Your Honors, I see that my orange light is on. I would just like to quickly point out the impact of this case. If the ICA decision stands, this will mean that any time a UIPA determination by OIP involves a statute outside the Sunshine Law, outside the UIPA, whether it be the Sunshine Law minute provision, which frequently arises, or any other of the many confidentiality or access statutes elsewhere in the HRS, OIP's decision will not be final. Record requesters will not be able to get access. The legislature intended for this to be a quick and informal process, and yet the requesters in this case have been waiting for years, and there will be many more like this, we would assume, since agencies will then be faced with the choice of complying with an OIP determination or suing OIP, and this leads to access being indefinitely denied, as well as straining OIP's slim resources. I thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice, fellow justices, and sitting justice. First off, I have to say I am honored to be here. David Minkin, with me is Becky Chestnut. In 25 years of practice, this is the first time I get to appear before this court. Thank you very much. What we have before this court, and there's no way around it, this is a Sunshine Law issue. No matter what OIP tries to do or how they try to color it, what occurred in this particular case began with the chair of the police commission asking about the notice for ES 177. He then later said that he was doing it in his personal capacity, not his official capacity. OIP sua sponte raises the issue of whether the council followed procedure for convening ES 177. OIP reviews the minutes, declares a violation of the Sunshine Law in its April 14, 2005 letter, and recommended disclosure in that letter to both the county and to Mr. Ching, now in his personal capacity, but no longer asserting an interest as chairman of the police commission. Only after that April 14, 2005 letter, under the Sunshine Law, that the OIP mandated that should be disclosed, is there any request for the minutes of the executive session. Mr. Ching requested on April 19th, and another individual requested on April 28th. Thereafter, the amici, who filed the amicus brief, requested ES 177 in June, and in addition to that particular executive session, also they requested various categories of 3.5 years of executive session minutes. OIP has managed to attempt to morph a Sunshine Law issue into a UIPA because they believe it allows them to hide behind an administrative decision that they argue both first to the trial court, then to the ICA, and then to this court, that no judicial body has the ability or authority to look at what was done and evaluate it. If the courts can review and evaluate constitutional violations, to argue to this court and argue as they did to the ICA and down at the trial court that, well, we are the final arbiter, too bad, so sad, that flies in the face of due process, that flies in the face of the ability of the courts to make sure, as a separate branch of government, that the administrative branch, OIP out of the Lieutenant Governor's office, opining as to issues related to the elected branch on the county of Kauai, somehow gets reviewed by someone along the way. Because if you take their argument about jurisdiction, they would have you believe it can't be done. And that is not the American system. That is not the process with the coexistent branches of government.
There is a federal court order outstanding,
yes,
indicating that these very minutes, ES 177, shall not be disclosed.
Is that correct. And that initially came in a case where then Police Chief Casey Lum was suing the county over defamation regarding comments by a police commissioner and others. And it was a matter of discovery. I wasn't involved in that case. Other counsel was. And it's correct, OIP was not involved in that case. And Casey Lum sought what had been withheld, ES-177, in discovery. The magistrate basically dealt with it initially. Then it was appealed to the sitting judge, and it's now on appeal before the Ninth Circuit. That order came down in November of 06, and it's still existing in effect, full force in effect today.
And the question presented to the magistrate and to the federal district court was this the same as presented here, that is that 92.4 and 92.5 are applicable. It's 92F, 92.4 and 92.5.
Correct. And
so,
basically,
so the same issues that are raised here essentially were raised on the federal side.
I believe that in my reading of it, yes, because it deals with the attorney-client privilege. And no matter what OIP tries to do about talking about how it's been limited, I believe some of the justices hit the nail right on the head and said, isn't it broader? Doesn't it expand? And I don't know how a legislative body can mandate or take away something that has existed, one of the oldest privileges that we know of.
The magistrate Curran and Judge Mulway both said they looked at the minutes and decided that it did fall under attorney-client privilege.
Correct.
And so, therefore, under the exception which prevents disclosure of ES-177.
Yes.
So would that federal court order fall under 92F13, which says that disclosure shall not be required of government records which pursuant to state or federal law, including an order of any state or federal court, are protected from disclosure?
I believe that it does wholeheartedly, and
well,
we made
why?
It.
Why?
I believe that it's a court order. Yes, it is still in effect. It's on appeal at this point in time. It has not been set aside. The OIP has done nothing to set it aside. We have notified them as soon as we became aware of it, and we filed it within our pleadings before the trial court. And based on that information, we believe that is a separate basis for protecting Executive Session 177.
If the legislature in its legislative history indicated that it wanted an expeditious review, therefore it didn't provide for an appeal from an OIP interpretation of the statute or an application of the statute, then how can you take the position you take?
Basically, I believe that when you look at Chapter 92, what we have is a situation where I believe that there is a right. Any person has the right to challenge a determination under 92. I believe that what has taken place, the capricious and arbitrary handling of this matter by OIP, on one occasion they say that we will keep it confidential. Later on, they will come back and say we can't keep it confidential. They tell the county that you can, it must be disclosed except for those portions which must be redacted, which is not in their mandate. Basically, what we have here is a situation where we have unfettered decision-making by an administrative agency with no one reviewing it. And I understand the legislative history, but I believe that, and I believe it was yourself, Justice Acoba, when there's a conflict between the various statutory schemes, what happens? And that's exactly what's happened in this particular case, and that's why OIP is attempting to convince everyone that this should be under 92F, and we believe that it's more appropriately under Chapter 92, which allows the right for any person to bring it before the court, to have the court make that determination.
Well, 92F says minutes refers to minutes of all meetings required by law to be public. So by law, I assume, would incorporate both 92 and 92F. So you could read those provisions in paramateria.
Yes.
So in that sense, if by law means or would include 92, then you could read those provisions together.
Correct.
Which would give you the right to an appeal, or party the right to an appeal?
Not an appeal. Basically, it's an original action in the circuit court, because
I'm sorry.
Is no appeal process.
Right.
There is no HOPPA requirements for dealing with OIP, and that's one of the things that is also troubling, that OIP has been mandated to set rules for how it makes its determination in 92-1.5, I believe it is, and to date, based upon the declaration of one of their staff attorneys, they do it literally on an ad hoc basis. There is no guidance provided whatsoever, and what we've learned here is that even the former chief of OIP, Mr. Kondo, has admitted he has reversed decisions by prior OIP directors. No one's indicated why. He has reversed those decisions. We have no knowledge whatsoever that they've ever undertaken any attorney-client privilege training, let alone utilize the Office of Disciplinary Counsel on this issue, and literally look at, from the county's perspective, this matter in a vacuum as if they are the schoolyard bully and they will make the decision. Too bad, so sad, you have to live with it. And that was what was most troubling to the county and from the point that we got involved in this particular matter. And it goes back to even when it was before Judge Masaoka on the original motion to dismiss. They argued, OIP, that, Judge, you have no authority over OIP based upon the legislative history and the statute. That has been, Judge Masaoka denied that contention, and contrary to the position that OIP takes, that Judge Watanabe just merely glossed over it and said, well, prior decision by the judge in the same by another judge in the same case, Judge Watanabe also looked at it and came to her own findings of facts and decision as to why she had jurisdiction over it. It wasn't just basically the old Wong versus city and county, I'm not going to disturb a ruling of another circuit court judge. Judge Watanabe also looked at it, gave credence to the prior decision of Judge Masaoka as to on the motion to dismiss, and basically set it aside. If possible, if OIP's position is validated in this case, it will have a chilling effect on elected officials seeking, in this case, the county council, seeking the advice consultation with their attorneys. And what's important from those attorneys that have been in private practice, it doesn't matter if the attorney's speaking throughout the conversation with the client. It's just as important for the attorney to listen to the client to assess information and make determinations and appropriately guide the client.
If I may interrupt you, Mr. Meekin, doesn't your position have the chilling effect on the right of the public to have access to these minutes? And we're dealing, if your position is correct, I don't see where UIPA really has any value here. I mean, we're dealing with minutes of a meeting that was held in January 2005, or we're 4.5 years later fighting over it. And that seems contrary to me to the legislative history that Ms. Brooks talked about in terms of what's the purpose of UIPA if you can hang this matter up in court for 4 or 5 years.
I understand those concerns, and those were concerns at the trial level also, and also at the ICA. That is a good desire and goal to reach. But to believe that the agency is going to make the right decision, in this case OIP, that comports with the law, there has to be some remedy for the county council to challenge that basically carte blanche that we've, you know, that OIP says they have, that should not exist to anyone in this society, and that's why the courts can get involved. And I understand that, yes, it's troubling that it has taken a number of years, but that's the situation that we're presented with, because OIP would not backtrack or go back on any of their positions whatsoever. And when they talk about you can redact a portion, the portion that they eventually said could be redacted was 3 lines in the entire transcript. That's not redacting something to protect the matter. And yes, the public does have a right to know, but the elected bodies under the law have the right to go into executive session.
But that's, isn't your remedy to go back to the legislature and change UIPA?
That is a potential remedy, but unfortunately we're sitting here with an order, a letter and correspondence from OIP that requires certain things to be done. And with the belief that it was protected, the communications were protected properly upon proper notice, upon a proper vote, rather than subjecting the individual council members to potential criminal or civil liability if they disclosed it, it was felt in June of 2005 to get it before the circuit court, which the statute allowed in Chapter 92. And yes, there is that ability to, you know, potentially go before the legislature. I don't know what's happened with that, and that's literally, I'm not a politician. Thank goodness.
The fact that the failure to disclose would be an element of a criminal charge, I think raises some concerns. If, as the legislature said, the OIP's decision-making process is an informal dispute resolution process, i.e. without any of the safeguards that would normally attend some kind of administrative proceeding, and if OIP's determination that disclosure was inappropriate or wrong, and that determination is an element to be proven in a criminal case, then is there a constitutional issue if we go along with the OIP process?
I believe that there is, Your Honor.
What's that issue?
I believe basically that we have a situation where OIP has put literally the council members between a rock and a hard place, because OIP is ordering disclosure. The council believes that it would be inappropriate. The council members believe that it would be inappropriate and violative of potential civil and expose them to civil and criminal liability. And what's significant is that OIP argues, well, you can have this good faith belief based upon our decision. I didn't see that anywhere in the statute or the case law. I didn't see that somehow if I was sued for in a civil case for disclosing information that shouldn't have been disclosed, that I could then somehow gain or have the OIP defend me or indemnify me in that particular case. And there is no safe harbor provision, like in certain situations for criminal violations, if you do thing at the behest or at the authorization of a governmental agency, that somehow you have no liability, either civilly or criminally. That doesn't exist here. So I believe that any time that a statute has the ability or an action has the ability to subject an individual to criminal sanctions or civil sanctions, that the Constitution has to come into play. And when a decision is made without the proper rulemaking processes, without Chapter 91 due process protections, I believe that it impacts...
Or the alternative provision in the OIP's, well, I don't know if it's OIP, or the statute itself, which says that actually the OIP determination on its own is an alternative to going to circuit court. So that, I take that back, that would only be in certain cases. But you cited the case of Mendoza-Lopez, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
What does that illustrate?
That illustrates that due process has to work its way through, that you literally have to have some procedure that tells you what you're doing, why you're doing it, and how you're doing it. Because otherwise you're left literally with no guarantees that you're going to be able to avoid any type of prosecution. I believe that it's instructive to us. I believe that it allows us to look at what's taken place in this situation and provide that type of overview that's necessary when dealing with the arguments of OIP as to why there's no jurisdiction, why the attorney-client privilege is narrow, and why the county should have, as of April 14, 2005, immediately disclosed these particular minutes.
Mr. Minkin, does the requester have a means to seek redress for a denial?
Yes, and in this particular case, Michael Ching did file a lawsuit. And what happened is the county, it didn't hit the computer, it didn't hit Ohiki in time, and it wasn't served on the county. So with the time frames that were set up, the county filed its own lawsuit, and Mr. Ching's lawsuit has been held in abeyance the entire time pending resolution of this case, both at the trial court, the appellate court, and the ICA, and now before justices.
So therefore, the requester's appeal can slow down the process anyway.
Yes.
Mr. Minkin, as far as the United States District Court case and its binding effect, did they consider the procedural requirements of the Sunshine Law in determining whether or not this was actually an executive meeting. Well, was that an issue before them? I mean, if this was not a closed or executive meeting, I think everybody agrees, then the minute should be public.
My understanding is that they didn't look at whether it was a proper executive session meeting. The district court focused solely on the issue of whether it was protected by attorney-client privilege.
You agreed that if it wasn't an executive or closed meeting, then it's a public meeting, and the minute should be made public.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't matter about the exception that we're talking about, right?
Correct.
And what the district court was talking about. Thank you.
Correct.
The district court referred to 92, Chapter 92, right? 4 and I think 5.
Correct.
So it was presented with the same arguments made here today, right? That
comparable arguments at least were made, yes.
Okay. That they referred, I think the decision refers to the OIP letter or the OIP decision that this ES-177 should not be disclosed.
It refers
to an opinion letter by OIP, I think.
OIP indicates that it should be disclosed as of April 14th, 05. And
I misspoke. Should be disclosed.
Correct. And thereafter, the actual request came in from Mr. Ching, another individual, the AMICI, as well as...
And so the Federal District Court, I think, expressly said it did not agree with OIP, right?
It basically found that the entire minutes were protected by the attorney-client privilege because they were inextricably bound together,
intertwined. So that, at least in the Federal District Court case, the court mentioned the redaction proposal and rejected the redaction proposal.
Yes.
Mr. Rinkin, am I in the circuit court, was there any issue as to whether or not the county had failed to comply with the preconditions for having an executive meeting under 92.4? Was that ever an issue?
Never raised.
Never raised. Thank you.
If ES-177 is disclosed, then what effect would that have with respect to at least the Federal District Court order?
I guess it could subject anyone that discloses it to a contempt of court because there's an order out there now saying it cannot be disclosed. And until that gets heard by the Ninth Circuit depending upon how they weigh in on it, anyone that would do so potentially could find themselves in a special proceeding or in an order to show cause before either Magistrate Curran or Judge Molloy, because it has been ordered not to be disclosed.
What position does that put the council in?
Basically, it keeps them in the same position that they've been in from day one when it was ordered disclosed on April 14th by OIP, that it could subject them to civil or criminal liability. And that civil or criminal liability is compounded now with the federal court orders, the magistrate and sitting judge's order regarding that it's protected by the attorney-client privilege and it should not be disclosed.
Let me just clarify one thing. You said that the requirements of Sunshine Law was not in question in terms of holding an executive meeting. Is that correct?
Basically, they came back and said the initial request from Police Commission Chairman Ching was this a proper notice to go into executive session, and is this the type of authority that they can utilize at the council level? Because there was a dispute, a little bit of background, the Police Commission didn't believe that the county council could, under its powers and duties and authority, investigate the police department because the police commission sat above the police department and below the council. That later dropped out as an issue, and what was done was there was proper notice, there was a proper vote, and the executive session continued thereafter, after basically the vote was taken with a three-quarters vote of the council. So what happened in based on the April 14th letter is that OIP, sua sponte, takes a look at it to see, well, is this what you really did, and under what basis did you do it, and then came back and said, well, we don't believe that attorney, you know, under the exceptions, that it meets any of the exceptions except for a particular three-line item that could be redacted. And that's the problem, that OIP looked at it narrowly, didn't have the proper training or expertise to literally deal with the attorney-client privilege issue, didn't seek out any, quote, experts, such as ODC, to get them to weigh in on it, have never, according to then-Director Kondo, had never had any in-house training regarding attorney-client privilege issues or client communications or how that gets discussed, weighed, or decided upon. And that's something that literally some of you know. I spent first part of my career as a prosecutor. I didn't have to worry about attorney-client privilege at all. Literally, when you go into the private sector or government sector, you have to learn and become acquainted with and develop a whole new area of expertise as to what it is to be an attorney, what it is to have a client, and if you have multiple clients, how you deal with the conflict of interest between those multiple clients. And that is basically, there are seminars, you go to ODC, you have continuing legal education, which starts in January. There are certain things that can be done to bring you up to speed if it's not something that's been there that you can utilize from your experience. And in this particular case, what has been painfully obvious to myself in advocating for the county on this is that OIP didn't have that expertise. They made a determination, and that determination, at least before, by the time it got to this court, has been ruled unsound by multiple judges, both at trial court levels as well as at the appellate level.
Ms. Minton, your motion for summary judgment that was ruled in your favor, the county's favor, and the cross motion by OIP.
Yes.
There are no issues regarding the requirements met or not met regarding the executive meeting?
Correct. Thank you. I see the orange light is on. I know it's the orange light because it was pointed out. I am colorblind, but that's one of the things I live with. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I would like to first point out that the Mendoza-Lopez case, also cited in OIP's briefs, stands for the proposition that where an unreviewable administrative order establishes an element of a criminal offense, judicial review will then be provided as part of the criminal prosecution. Rebuttal time is gone. I would just like to again emphasize that there are competing policy interests at play in this case. The legislature recognized this and, as a policy matter, made a call in favor of narrow interpretation against closed meetings and in favor of the public interest, both in the UIPA and the Sunshine Law. Thank you.
Thank you, both counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.